Next, we have the privilege of hearing from Lee Cancio, who's the director of the U.S. Army Burn Center. And Dr. Cancio has really been at the forefront of, you know, the past decade and a half of casualty care, whether downrange or back in the burn center taking care of some of the sickest patients on this planet. Dr. Cancio is going to focus on the combat casualty care aspects and the resuscitation. So, Lee, please.
Thank you, Captain Elster. Standard disclaimer. So, the amount of progress made in combat casualty care during World War I is truly amazing, coupled with the types of problems, as alluded to previously, that these people faced. And it really is a testament to their hard work and dedication. And that's the most important message I want to get across. And I didn't know a lot about this topic. I knew something. It really is a vast amount of progress. Justin talked about the lethality of the battlefield, which had greatly increased by the time of World War I, resulting in wounds like you see here, which frankly are common to those of us who have seen the results of improvised explosive devices in the Middle East, but nevertheless represented a leap forward, if you will, in casualty severity during World War I. Good. Meanwhile, the environment was horrible in these trenches. Mud and dirt pervaded everything. These soldiers lived and died and sometimes were buried in these trenches. As a consequence of this, it is not surprising that gangrene, so-called gas gangrene, was identified in about 10% of wounded, although this probably represented a variety of different life-threatening infections as shown here. The point is that infections in this pre-antibiotic and in some cases pre-surgical era were associated with a 50% mortality rate. Now, in the middle of the 19th century, Joseph Lister, an English surgeon, developed a new concept, that of antisepsis, and he utilized carbolic acid, which previously had been used to reduce the stench associated with fields irrigated with human manure. Carbolic acid was partially effective in reducing infection associated with surgery. He assumed, or he thought, that infections were spread by the atmosphere in the operating room. And in order to address this, one of the things that he did was spray carbolic acid over the patient, the operators, and the instruments. He did recognize that the likely cause of infection were the minute organisms, but he assumed they were being transmitted by the atmosphere. Nonetheless, he introduced the concept of antisepsis into surgery, which was then refined. Now, Alexis Carrel, as previously mentioned, was responsible for introducing antisepsis into battlefield surgery during World War I. It is amazing to me that he had already won the Nobel Prize for advances in vascular surgery, and nonetheless, he sought to devote himself to solving the problem of battlefield infection. And he did so using what was termed the Carrel-Dakin technique, which included analysis of the effect of antiseptics on microbial counts in wounds, and included not just a solution to the problem, but a surgical technique by which the solution was deployed. And his publications are very thorough with respect to describing how to get the antiseptic fluid down into the wounds. He worked, of course, with Henry Drysdale Dakin, an English chemist who tested 200 potential antiseptics with respect to their antimicrobial properties, but also with respect to their T tissue toxicity properties, finally concluding that sodium hypochlorites buffered with boric acid was the best solution, a solution which we do still use today in the treatment of difficult wounds. However, Corel, and to a perhaps greater extent, Antoine Depage, a Belgian surgeon, recognized the importance not just of antisepsis, but also of removal of dead, contused, non-viable, and infected tissue from these wounds. The term that we use today, debridement, is not what he meant by debridement during the First World War. Debridement meant opening up the wound tract, essentially unbridling or releasing the wound tract, followed by épluchage, which was peeling or combing through the tissue to remove the dead material. So just opening up the tissue is insufficient. We actually have to remove dead stuff. These are concepts which today we continue to teach and which are vitally important to the care of wounded patients. Here you see him with Queen Elizabeth of Belgium, who volunteered in his hospital. Dr. Depage also defined closure strategies, which we now know as delayed primary closure, and healing by secondary intention. He also guided his decision to close wounds, the timing of wound closure, according to culture results, and had Alexander Fleming helping him with that at his hospital. He documented the results of his wound closure efforts, and he established an institute for the study of these problems on the ground at his hospital, which he named after his late wife, who had been killed in the sinking of the Lusitania. Now, let's talk about shock. The period leading up to the First World War involved the development of concepts of fluid and heart physiology, exemplified by Ernest Starling, who developed, of course, the concept of the Starling forces to explain microvascular fluid movement. And he stated that this is the balance of forces necessary to explain the regulation of the quantity of circulating fluid, a realization that was essential for trying to understand shock seen on the battlefield. He was a collaborator with Walter B. Cannon, a U.S. physiologist, chair of physiology at Harvard, who recognized in his lecture published in the predecessor journal to the New England Journal that there was no clear definition of surgical shock. They understood that wounded soldiers developed perturbations of their physiology, but they didn't know what caused it. And there were various theories. Cannon suggested that it might be blood loss, but it also might be pooling of blood in the splanchnic circulation. He proposed injecting vasopressin and oxytocin in order to correct this splanchnic pooling. Despite the fact that he was chairman of physiology at Harvard, he deployed in 1917 with the Harvard team to Base Hospital 5 on the battlefield. It was not enough for him to be at the base hospital. He moved forward to the casualty clearing station in order to do shock research closer to the front. He worked on a German soldier. He identified absence of splanchnic pooling in that soldier. He identified that intraperitoneal injection of vasopressin oxytocin was ineffective, and he measured blood gases in casualties using a Vance-like manometric device. He determined that blood loss caused acidosis, or alternatively, that acidosis was the cause of shock. And he went back to the lab in London the same year to work on cats in Bayliss's lab, ultimately admitting that shock causes acidosis, not the other way around. All of this he achieved in 1 year. Meanwhile, in London, Dr. Bayliss, a physiologist, inherited wealth from his parents and therefore built a home physiology laboratory on a 4-acre plot near Hampstead Heath in London. He studied colloid versus crystalloid, and he concluded that colloid was superior to crystalloid for the restitution, for the restoration of circulating plasma volume. And the colloid of the day was gum arabic, which was obtained from the Acacia Senegal tree. These authors, however, also realized that some patients might require blood transfusion in order to address shock. And transfusion was brand new at the time of the First World War. There were two Robertsons involved in developing transfusion for the battlefield. One was L. Bruce Robertson, who introduced the syringe technique, where you take a large syringe and you remove blood from one individual and inject it into the patient. He did this first in kids in Toronto, and then he took it to the battlefield. He did the first battlefield transfusion in 1919, and the next year he reported on 36 transfused patients. They did not do blood typing in those patients, and two of those patients had an acute hemolytic reaction. He decided that the benefits of transfusion seen in those who did well outweighed the risks associated with those who died of transfusion reaction. Fortunately, however, Oswald Robertson, no relation, an English-American physician, had previously done some work on blood typing. He deployed with the Harvard team. He established the first blood bank. He developed a bottle which served to both accommodate blood removed from a donor and then to store it and then to be a receptacle from which blood could be transfused. He also identified universal donor blood and described transfusing 22 times into 20 patients without adverse effects with acceptable outcomes. So what about gas warfare? So this was a huge problem with 1.3 million casualties. It contributed to a big increase in understanding of gas physiology, and in particular to understanding how to use oxygen therapeutically in wounded individuals. Haldane, for example, the individual who came up with the first diving tables and who studied decompression illness, carried out numerous tests on the effects of chlorine gas on himself and other volunteers, and this is a recurring theme. These physiologists were not adverse to operating on themselves or experimenting on themselves. This is Joseph Barcroft. He was interested in altitude physiology, and here you see an altitude chamber that he built, cannulated his radial artery, had it tied off. So tie off the radial artery, cannulate it, go into the chamber for 7 days, and gradually decrease the atmospheric pressure in the chamber until he got sick, and recorded his experiences in the chamber. So this is the type of experiments that they did. He came to take over the Gas Warfare Center at Porton Down during World War I and II, and he made the observation that a lot of the chronic survivors of gas warfare seemed to have symptoms similar to those individuals who went to high altitudes. And therefore, he suggested we could use oxygen to treat both groups of individuals and created oxygen chambers, identifying an improvement in symptoms as a result. He also did auto-experimentation on gas warfare agents and published on cyanide. He went into an airtight chamber with a dog. He released cyanide gas into the air and made observations of the dogs and his own symptoms until the dog began to seize and became unconscious. He carried the dog out of the chamber and then felt ill. By virtue of this type of heroic work, these physiologists advance our understanding of physiology and therefore the treatment of patients with pulmonary injury. Another such individual was Frank Underhill. Underhill performed experiments on what he described as thousands of dogs and goats on the various warfare agents of the time, chlorine, phosgene, and chlorpiperine, and performed or provided an excellent description of inhalation injury, which is consistent with what we observe today in survivors of smoke inhalation injury. He also identified the potential to utilize oxygen as a way of treating these patients who became dyspneic after exposure. This work later contributed to our understanding of burn physiology when he similarly identified hemoconcentration, which he termed anhydremia, in survivors of the 1921 Rialto Theater fire in New Haven, Connecticut. He proposed that hemoconcentration was a result of pulmonary edema formation in the case of war gas injury and of loss of plasma into the burn wound in the case of fire survivors, and thus proposed the use of crystalloid solutions for the resuscitation of burn casualties, another important advance which we can attribute to World War I. What about some special problems? As previously mentioned, non-operative treatment was the so-called military standard of care for abdominal injuries at the time of World War I. But military surgeons reasoned that we ought to be able to do better than that now that civilian patients were being treated with operation for abdominal injury. This began, for example, with Cuthbert Wallace, who compared results during the so-called expectant period, in which abdominal injury patients were simply monitored, to the operative period, and he showed an important improvement in mortality from 80% to about 50% when operation was introduced. In this series here, we see that mortality was a function of how fast the casualty could be brought to operative therapy. In this summary of many case series, what nowadays we would call a meta-analysis, the authors found that there was an important improvement in mortality, even though mortality still remained high. Still, it was a step forward. DePage also argued in favor of early intervention and showed an improvement in mortality from 65 to 45%. To me, all this is important because it demonstrates that these authors are recording their results and they're comparing one therapy to another in a critical fashion, something which I don't believe had happened before. What about orthopedics? Fritz Steinmann invented the Steinmann pin, which may be familiar to many of us. He first made these pins in the hospital metal shop and sterilized them in boiling water. I don't think we could get away with this today, and this transformed how orthopedic surgery was performed on the battlefield. Also, we see the beginning of rehabilitation of individuals with extremity trauma. Down at the bottom, by the way, what you see here is the use of solar radiation therapy, i.e. sunshine, for the treatment of casualties with various complex wounds on the theory that sunlight was good for preventing or treating infection. Now, what about Harvey Cushing? Surely one of the greats of American surgery from the last century, or perhaps for many centuries, resident of Halstead and known as the father of neurosurgery. By by the time of his deployment, he already had, similar to Correll, a long list of accomplishments, not the least of which was the introduction of the anesthesia record, the description of the Cushing reflex, the first blood pressure devices in the U.S., first animal lab for teaching surgery at Hopkins, the first text on neurosurgery and description of pituitary surgery. And yet, despite that accomplishment record, he decided to deploy. He deployed to France with the Harvard team, and he described experiences with brain surgery. He described how to do brain surgery on combat casualties, and he identified an important improvement in mortality as a result of his experience on the battlefield. He also identified potential pitfalls of operative care. Not all of his ideas were successful. Here you see him using a magnetized nail to extract a metallic framework from the brain of a casualty. Already mentioned was the problem of overwhelming numbers of casualties. What would we do if we encountered 1,000 casualties arriving at our hospital with these types of grievous wounds? Certainly, triage became absolutely necessary, although in many cases, triage was conceived not just as a way to take care of the most immediately needy patients first, but also, and sometimes more importantly, to return soldiers who could be returned to the battlefield faster. Echelons of care, also mentioned, also a function of fixed battle lines whereby resources could be distributed and more resources could be further away from the front lines. All right, so conclusions. So multiple problems were addressed aggressively by these surgeons and physiologists. The record is amazing. The question is, in my mind, why? Why did it happen then and not previously? First of all, there was a scientific approach to surgical problems, exemplified by the new program in surgical training established by Halstead and by the new program in medical education proposed by Flexner. And all of these people, by the way, were colleagues and talked to each other. There was integrated clinical and laboratory research, a term used by Dr. Pruitt here, but these people, these surgeons, physiologists, and others incorporated this on the battlefield of World War I by bringing surgical and basic scientists together and, as previously mentioned, publishing extensively to disseminate their findings. Finally, the deployment of academic surgical teams is an innovation which should be praised and recognized as contributing to the quality of care on the battlefield. Finally, we recognize that in time of war, perfect science is difficult to achieve, but the physiology of today is the medicine of tomorrow. And thank you very much for your attention.